You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, what do you have for us today?
A new report into climate change in West Africa, Zimbabwe's election chaos, and Newcastle striker Papi Cisse stands up to the club sponsor Wonga.com.
Sticking with our Africa focus, two witnesses in the International Criminal Court case against Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, have withdrawn. That's over fears for their security. We'll be on the line with our man in Nairobi.
Plus, as we reach the 19th stage of La Tour de France, we ask what the British favourite is up to.
Froome has, to some extent, got it in the neck because he is so formidable and he has turned into the most powerful rider of his age. And I think there were some boos directed at him just out of resentment and with the veiled accusation.
We'll also go on a gastronomic tour of Lisbon.
We definitely think or act local. We want to use Portuguese products. We want to use Portuguese flavors.
All that plus we speak to our man in Budapest. We'll look at the Brazilian front pages this morning as well. And we might even play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
One minute past eight in the morning. Lots to get through this morning. But first, let's catch up on the headlines now with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Detroit has filed for bankruptcy with debts of at least $15 billion. It's the largest US city ever to apply for bankruptcy. If a federal judge approves the application, the city's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who was appointed by the state of Michigan, will be allowed to liquidate city assets to satisfy creditors and pensions. He says bankruptcy is the first step towards restoring the city. Mayor Dave Bing says Detroit will stay open with services continuing and staff and bills being paid. Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder said he'd approve Mr. Orr's request to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy.
This was a difficult and painful decision, but I believe there were no other viable options. Why did I do this? What's the rationale and what's the impact for both the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan? Well, let me start with the fact that this is a situation that's been 60 years in the making in terms of the decline of Detroit. From a financial point of view, let me be blunt. Detroit's broke.
The White House has said that the United States is deeply disappointed and concerned at the conviction of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who was jailed for 5 years after being found guilty of stealing money from a timber firm. He denied the charges, saying his trial was politically motivated. Thursday's verdict was seen by many as a sign that President Putin sees Navalny as a threat. He'd registered to run in Moscow's mayoral election later this year. White House spokesman Jay Carney says the sentence is the latest example of a disturbing trend aimed at suppressing dissent in civil society in Russia.
We urge Russia to allow for a fair and impartial appeal of the verdict. At the same time, we call on the Russian government to cease its campaign of pressure against individuals and groups seeking to expose corruption and to ensure that the universal human rights and fundamental freedoms of all of its citizens, including the freedoms of speech and assembly, are protected and respected.
A U.S. police photographer has released pictures of the Boston Marathon suspect Dzhokhar Tsarnaev taken during his capture. Sergeant Sean Murphy said he'd released the images to Boston magazine because he was angry at a picture of Tsarnaev which appeared on the front cover of Rolling Stone magazine. He said the Rolling Stone cover was hurtful to the victims' memories and their families, while his picture showed the real bomber. A state police spokesman said the release of the pictures had been unauthorized and Sergeant Murphy was now subject to an internal investigation. A Japan Airlines Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which was heading for Tokyo, has been forced to return to Boston after a mechanical indicator alert came on. An airline spokesperson said the flight had turned back as a standard precautionary measure due to a maintenance message indicator. Meanwhile, investigators looking into last week's fire on a parked Boeing 787 Dreamliner at Heathrow Airport say they believe they've identified the cause. The UK's Air Accidents Investigation Branch says a transmitter used to locate aircraft after a crash needs more airworthiness actions. They also say the problem might not be confined to the Dreamliner and recommend safety reviews of similar components in other aircraft. A new report for the British government and the Mayor of London says last year's Olympics and Paralympics boosted the UK economy by £9.9 billion. The report says new contracts, additional sales and foreign investment over the past year are down to the Games. Independent estimates are predicting that by 2020, the overall benefit to the economy will be between £28 and £41 billion. The latest report also said nearly 1.5 million people more are taking part in sport at least once a week than were in 2005, when London was named as the host city. And Prime Minister David Cameron says there's also been a strong social legacy, with thousands of people being inspired by the Games volunteers to become involved with local sports clubs. The northeastern United States is sweltering in a heat wave, with Friday's temperatures expected to pass 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The National Weather Service has issued heat advisories for dozens of northeastern cities and surrounding areas in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, upstate New York and Long Island. It also warned of the dangers of heat-related illnesses, asking residents to be on the lookout for signs of fatigue, sunstroke, muscle cramps and heat exhaustion. These people in New York's Washington Square admitted they really were feeling the heat.
Drinking a lot of fluids, the fan is on all day, all night, so we're just trying to keep cool.
Probably the hottest day of the year, but I love hot weather. It is a little bit overwhelming though, so I kind of wish I had a bathing suit so I could jump in the fountain right now.
It's way too hot. Any chance I get to pass air conditioning, I stop and I'm like, this is nice. This is way too hot.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
We're feeling the heat in London as well, and I do have to admit that I went into a grocery store the other day and just stood in front of the open freezer section.
It's a once a year occurrence.
Yeah, well, we love it, don't we? Thanks very much, Barney. It's 7 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, dette er Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, live from Studio One in London, where it's quite cool, actually, in the studio, given the heat wave. This is the time of the show when we tell you the three important stories that you need to have in mind over the next 24 hours. And today, our agenda setter is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and he joins us live in the studio. Lovely to see you, James.
Thanks for having me.
As always. Should we start with climate change? Seems quite topical.
Yes, there's a new report that came out this morning from the International Water Management Institute about the Volta Basin, which is in West Africa, Ghana and Burkina Faso mainly. And 24 million people live there. And the report says that the area is likely to have larger increases in temperature caused by climate change, something like 3.6%, which means that more of the water is going to evaporate, which means that irrigation, water-based farming is going to be increasingly difficult in an area which already is quite food unstable. And then one of the things that governments there have been trying to do has been to use the basin for energy, so building hydroelectric dams. And then the report also says that because of the loss of water flow caused by the evaporation, caused by the increasing temperature, even if all of the projected projects go forward, the amount of energy that they'll get out of it is still the same that they get now in 100 years' time because there's less water.
It is quite a startling figure. And another startling figure, the population in that part of the world, 19 million people lived there in 2000. Mm. That jumps up to 34 million yeah. by 2015. That's a startling increase considering that, you know, there's going to be serious problems there with water, energy, irrigation, farming. Yeah.
So, exactly, and a large percentage of the population currently living on the land. The population, it was 19, 13 years ago. It's now 24 million, as you say. So it's almost going to double, and it's almost going to double in an area where the amount of resources available are going to roughly half. It's going to be a large problem, and given that one of the drivers of violence in the Ivory Coast a couple of years ago was migrants moving from this area down for better farming land and better opportunities in Ivory Coast. And this was one of the real drivers. It could be potentially bad for regional stability.
This is probably a futile question in the face of such grievous statistics, but what can be done?
Well, the report is recommending some changes in, local mitigation, some changes in agricultural practices, less water reliant. And there's something about changing the way that you do irrigation, which I'm afraid I'm not an agronomist. I don't quite understand, but there's something there which seems quite good. But it falls into the kind of broader discussion of climate change is going to looks like it's going to much more affect the African continent and other poorer areas of the world than rich areas of the world. And so it falls into a...
doing so, therefore, affects the rich nations of the world.
It does there affect, but not quite directly. As much and not so directly. So it adds weight to the justice arguments that the rich world should probably look about doing something to do with climate change, so that rather than it raising by 3.4%, maybe that is 2.5%, which maybe is, lessens all of the problems.
And James, we're coming up to the end of the month, and that means it's time for the Zimbabwean election.
Yes,
the showdown
absolutely.
Between Tsvangirai and Mugabe is set to happen at the end of the month. What are the latest developments on that front?
Mugabe's got very upset because the advisor on Zimbabwean affairs for Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, has called up Mugabe and said, look, things are not going very well, and has said publicly things aren't going very well and this election does not look good. This morning in the headlines, more is the America saying that the election is looking very flawed and chaotic, but really it's the response of South Africa that matters much more. And America saying that things aren't good almost feeds into Mugabe's rhetoric. Mm. But when neighbouring South Africa, which is going to be the country that's going to have to broker any kind of agreement if that has to happen, is saying that no, this election is, there are massive problems with the voter election roll. It's happened way too quickly. There's been no security sector reform. The pace, the timetabling of the election was decided only by Mugabe and with the opposition not supporting that. And that's way more important.
I mean, from South Africa's point of view, the stakes are obviously very high. They will bear the burden if another flood of refugees, if
Absolutely.
Another huge amount of violence, as we saw in 2008, will also stretch them financially. What can they do, though, at this point?
Well, this is the problem. Not really very much, and no one can do really very much because...
I mean, how helpful is it for them to stand up and say it's in disarray and it's...
Well, I think they have to because of how silent they were relatively last time around. And given that most election observers haven't been allowed in, it is important for the historical record and also for the international community to know that the election is looking seriously flawed.
And the woman that you mentioned earlier, this is the same advisor to Zuma that Mugabe called a stupid, idiotic woman earlier this month as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
He always was a charmer, wasn't he?
He's a lovely man.
There's another story regarding a jersey and football, and perhaps not wanting to wear that jersey.
Yes. Papiss Cissé, who's a Senegalese striker and a devout Muslim for Newcastle, looks like he might have to leave the club because he's refusing to play in their strip, which is now sponsored by Wonga.com, which is a UK-based payday lender. And he says, and I think quite rightly, that it's against his Islamic faith and therefore he can't be seen to be promoting something which charges 5,000% interest rates.
Fair enough. What do you think will happen? What does this mean? What are the bigger implications for football sponsorship? And as we see more and more players come from parts of the world where, there are more and more Muslim players in the league, which would never have happened, even 10 years ago, is likely to rumble on?
Yes. Well, I mean, the increase in Muslim players in the Premier League is already changing it. So when the Premier League started in 92, there was one Muslim player. Now there are a whole host of them. Man of the Match report, the prize for Man of the Match is no longer a bottle of champagne, it's a trophy. That's a change that's been made. But more broadly about, people not liking sponsors, I think it looks like there is a backlash. Bolton fans are currently protesting against their new sponsor, which is Quick Quid, which is another one of these payday lending companies that have sprung up since the financial crisis. And I think we're going to see a lot more of disjoint between what players, fans and supporters of the game want and how they're going to pay for it.
It's interesting as a kind of clash of cultures and civilizations. Mm. We were talking earlier about Qatar and how it prepares for the 2022 World Cup. And I suppose these sorts of issues will continue to raise their heads.
Yeah, but the thing that I think is rather nice is how the fans seem to be more on the side of the players than perhaps the managers and controllers of the game. So Newcastle had another case. Demba Ba, who's another striker a couple years ago, was fasting for Ramadan. His manager said, oh, he's not being very good because he's fasting for Ramadan. And so the fans wrote a song for him where the lyrics recited every single goal he scored during Ramadan, and he got massive support from the terraces.
It's wonderful. I think, you know, it's been such a development from let's kick racism out of football. I remember when I first started going to football when I was very young, racism was still endemic across football terraces. And now I do feel that there has been a real shift, and it's encouraging, it's very nice.
Yeah.
Excellent stuff. James, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Many thanks for joining us
on the
program.
Well, sticking with our Africa focus, coming up next, we're going to find out why the International Criminal Court may have to drop charges against Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. Stay with us.
Who's that big, handsome thing getting all the looks on the beach, attracting envious glances by the pool, and too many amorous advances in the sun-dappled cafe? That's right, it's Monocle Mediterraneo, our big, bold, large-format newspaper that reports from the sunnier southern European spots each summer. Our editors have been scouring ports on the rise and plage for pleasure to bring you a host of reads to enjoy with your Aperol this vacation season.
In the design section, we kick back in two stunning holiday residences, a mid-century gem on the volcanic island of Pantelleria and a beautifully crafted fortress in the Atlas Mountains. We also go on an architour around the Sarrià Sant Gervasi district of Barcelona and uncover some beautifully intact post-war designs.
In the edit section, we relax and take a break by the beach while we await our food and drink to be served, courtesy of four Mediterranean chefs, including the number one chef in the world. And to keep in shape, we travel to the surf towns of Erachira, Sesme and Batroun to catch a few waves and a bit of sunshine too.
Make sure you get your copy of Monocle Mediterraneo. It's on newsstands now, or order a copy from monocle.com. You'll be the envy of all the lounger lizards.
It's 11:17 in Moscow, it's 10:17 in Nairobi, and it is 8:17 here in London. And it's a hard blow for the prosecution against Uhuru Kenyatta, the president of Kenya. Two witnesses have dropped out of the International Criminal Court's case against him. One, at least, argues that testifying would be too dangerous.
The Hague is trying to pin charges for crimes against humanity on Kenyatta and his men, whom they accuse of orchestrating the violence that killed over 1,000 people following the 2007 election. Last March, prosecutors already had to drop the case against one of Kenyatta's civil servants after another key witness refused to testify. Well, to discuss this further and what it means in 2013, we're on the line now with Tristan McConnell, Monocle's man in Nairobi. Good morning, Tristan.
Morning.
Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Witness protection in Kenya is a state-run enterprise, but since it's the head of state who's been charged with, the witnesses obviously feel very vulnerable, both personally and in terms of their extended families. So can we hope for anything like a fair trial?
The ICC prosecutor is still determined that she's going to push ahead with her prosecution of Uhuru Kenyatta, as well as the other accused, William Ruto, the deputy president, and Joshua Sang, who's a radio presenter. Despite these kinds of setbacks, but you're absolutely right, witness protection is proving to be a real problem. The case against Kenyatta's co-accused, Francis Nassara, collapsed after a key witness recanted. And now we've had these other witnesses also pull out, at least one of them citing security fears. And this really gets to the heart of the problem that was identified by a number of human rights groups when the witness protection bill was passed in Kenya a few years ago. And that's the witness protection is a state-run enterprise. It's within the office of the Attorney General. Protection is provided by a police force and others. And all of these institutions are under investigation, are thought to be somehow complicit in the killings and so on that went on after the elections in 2007. So it's easy to see how a witness may not feel particularly secure in this situation.
Absolutely. And Tristan, I'm quite fascinated by the role of the African Union in all of this. They've been pressuring the ICC to drop this case. They've said publicly that they believe the ICC is being racist for pursuing only strictly African issues. Tell us about their role in this and how that would potentially develop in the coming months with the trial continuing.
Yeah, I think for human rights activists and people interested in victims receiving justice, the African Union's sort of machinations are completely, you know, depressing. They're playing a real despoiler role against justice for victims of these kind of horrendous abuses. And the thing that these African Union officials seem to be deliberately ignoring is that although every case that's been opened so far is located in Africa, in the vast majority of those cases, the ICC was invited in by the governments in question. Kenya is the only exception to that rule, and that was brought about after the prosecutor said he was going to investigate kind of his own bat. But that was, you know, following the Kenyan government's complete failure to begin any sort of judicial process here in Kenya, and a really big kind of public desire to see justice done, and understanding that the Kenyan judiciary, as it was back then, was incapable of delivering justice against powerful political elites. So, you know, this argument that the ICC is racist is really a red herring, but it's one that's proving quite damaging to international justice.
And how does this all play out on the ground, Tristan?
Well, it's not playing out very well. I mean, despite what the prosecutor says about her determination to continue with these trials, every time that we see a blow against the prosecution case, whether it's the collapse of the case against one of the co-accused, whether it's witnesses withdrawing for whatever reason, it makes the ICC look weak, and that makes people in Kenya begin to think that maybe they're never going to see justice done, which is really the way it's been for decades since independence. I mean, the political elites involved in political violence, corruption, and so forth are never brought to book. And there was a strong feeling that, you know, once you got the International Criminal Court involved, there was finally a court that could not be bought off, could not be threatened, could not be killed, and that, you know, finally we'd see some justice done. And every one of these recent events undermines that. And the worst is really for, you know, the victims. And let's not forget, there were over 1,100 people who were killed, hundreds of thousands of people forced from their homes, had their property destroyed. And they've seen not a single bit of justice come their way. And for them, you know, this is a terribly depressing turn of events, because they thought they would see some sort of redress. And that goal seems to be slipping ever further from view at the moment.
Well, let's hope it doesn't slip out of view entirely. We'll be watching that story as it develops, and I'm sure Tristan will be talking to you again soon. Tristan McConnell, our man in Nairobi, thanks for joining us here on Midori House. We're heading to Le Grand Bournon next for the 19th stage of Le Tour de France. Don't go anywhere.
It is 9:23 in Marseille. It's 8:23 here in London, and it is 23 minutes past midnight in Los Angeles. Now to France. Le Tour reaches its 19th stage today, and the director of the competition has warned this is a stage for the bold. 204.5 kilometers and five peaks to climb, two of them above 1,500 meters. Oh, that sounds exhausting. Well, with only 3 days of competition left, those in the peloton de tête will feel the pressure more than ever.
Christophe Riblon, a Frenchman, triumphed on the iconic Alpe d'Huez yesterday. But where does this leave the UK favourite Chris Froome? A little earlier, we put the question to Geoffrey Wheatcrot, the legendary journalist and author of Le Tour, a history of the Tour de France, and general tour aficionado.
Geoffrey, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Chris Froome, he had a bit of a trouble yesterday, but he still managed to extend his lead. Is he unstoppable? Is he going to win on the Champs-Élysées?
Well, at the moment it looks like it, unless some terrible disaster befalls him. He's got a very large lead by Tour de France standards, and they have got two extremely tough days ahead of them, today and tomorrow. The Sunday is a formality, but it looks as though he's going to do it. Yesterday was completely fascinating, because it was the first time that Froome had shown any real weakness on this tour. They went up not the famous Alpe d'Huez climb in the Alps, where we now are, not once but twice, having come down on a pretty perilous descent in between. And towards the very end, Froome was clearly troubled, and he was wobbling, and he put up his hand, signalling. And his teammate dropped back to get to the team car, and then came back to him, Richie Porte, that is, the Australian, and handed him something. And what it was, it looked at first as though he had a mechanical problem, but what Froome had actually had was what English cyclists call the bonk, when all the blood sugar in the body is exhausted, and you suddenly think you've hit a brick wall. And he needed a sugar gel to revive him, which was strictly illegal at that point of the race, and he was docked 20 seconds, but that's not going to hurt him.
What might have hurt him would have been if any of these doping claims and the doping shadow that's lengthened over the tour had come to fruition, but it looks as if that's clear now. Team Sky have handed over to the French sports daily L'Équipe the findings of 18 of his climbs since he made his breakthrough, and those have been found to be consistent with doping-free cycling. Does that mean he's completely free of that now?
Well, it doesn't mean... That's a very good question, Clemency. I mean, it doesn't mean that he's completely free, because there is an atmosphere of suspicion and insinuation surrounding cycling, which all the riders today have to deal with. Some of them are very understandably resentful if they are clean, and I think Froome and the Sky team are. That is to say, I believe and hope they are, then it's understandable they should resent these accusations. But on the other hand, given what cycling has been through over the last 20 years, and the simply appalling scandal of Lance Armstrong and the American team, that they have to put up with it. And they've done exactly as you've described. They've handed over a great deal of his personal data about very technical matters like wattage output and strength to energy ratio, to show that he is not what French racing journalists used to call Armstrong extraterrestrial, which was a heavy hint, you know, that he was not using simply normal dietic methods. And I think that Froome and Dave Brailsford, his manager, who was also the manager of the brilliant British Olympics team, have handled it quite carefully, having been rather resentful to begin with. And incidentally, what happened yesterday may work out rather well, because what we saw, and it's on this Alpe d'Huez climb they did yesterday twice, Lance Armstrong, 10 years ago, used to pass the field as if they were standing still on this very climb, which is like a ski slope, it's so steep. And we all were awestruck and thought, how on earth can he possibly do it? Well, now we know how he did it. The fact that Froome had a défiance, as the French say, and he faltered, means, in a way, might be a sign that he is indeed riding on normal nutritional means.
And Geoffrey, this is the first Tour de France since Lance Armstrong admitted that he did dope. I'm quite interested. You've been covering the race since it began. What have the crowds been like there in France? Have you still noticed that kind of enthusiasm and passion for the sport? Or do you think it's kind of waned a bit since the Armstrong he admitted to doping?
There would be a dimmed passion, and that people would become thoroughly cynical and fed up with bike racing after this simply dreadful scandal. And the French in particular, you might think, would be rather fed up because they haven't won the race, rather like the English and Wimbledon. But then we went, whatever it was, 77 years without winning the men's title at Wimbledon, and that didn't stop people going to watch Wimbledon. And the French, to judge from the crowds this year, were absolutely vast crowds. I didn't drive up Alpe d'Huez yesterday, but I did drive up Mont Ventoux last Sunday ahead of the riders, and the throng was colossal. Some people reckoned there were 500,000, 750,000 spectators, and there was another immense crowd yesterday. So the Tour de France has not, mercifully, lost its appeal at all.
But Geoffrey, many of the crowds at Mont Ventoux on Sunday were booing. Do you think they were booing Chris Froome, or were they booing? What were they booing for?
Well, some of them were booing Chris Froome. There are a few nutters. If you watched it on television, you'll see that a lot of the crowd are sort of there's a fine line between being enthusiastic and simply crazy. They get dressed up in ludicrous costumes and they chase the cyclists on these climbs. And sometimes the cyclist has to push them aside physically. And there are people who will boo footballers, you know, for unpleasant reasons or for sometimes understandable reasons, there is this miasma of suspicion hanging over the race, and Froome has to some extent got it in the neck because he is so formidable and he has turned into the most powerful rider of his age. And I think there were some boos directed at him just out of resentment and with the veiled accusation. But as we were saying, they, I think, have dealt with this rather carefully and rather successfully.
That was Geoffrey Wheatcroft, the author and journalist, speaking to me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn, just before we came to air. We've got a packed half hour of the rest of the show, but first let's get the world headlines now from Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Clemmy. Detroit has filed for bankruptcy with debts of at least $15 billion. It's the largest US city ever to apply for bankruptcy. The mayor says the city will stay open with services continuing and staff and bills being paid. The Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who was jailed yesterday after being found guilty of stealing money from a timber firm, has been temporarily freed from custody ahead of an appeal against his 5-year sentence. He denies the charges, saying his trial was politically motivated. A US police photographer has released pictures of the Boston Marathon suspect Dzhokhar Tsarnaev taken during his capture. Sergeant Sean Murphy said he'd released the images to Boston magazine because he was angry at a picture of Tsarnaev which appeared on the front cover of Rolling Stone magazine. A Japan Airlines Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which was heading for Tokyo, has been forced to return to Boston after a mechanical indicator alert came on. An airline spokesperson said the flight had turned back as a standard precautionary measure. A new report for the British government and the Mayor of London says last year's Olympics and Paralympics boosted the UK economy by £9.9 billion. Independent estimates are predicting that by 2020, the overall benefit to the economy will be between £28 and £41 billion. And the northeastern United States is sweltering in a heat wave, with Friday's temperatures expected to pass 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The National Weather Service has issued heat advisories for dozens of northeastern cities and surrounding areas in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, upstate New York and Long Island. Those are the hotlines, or if you prefer, the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. And Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. It is 8:32 in Lisbon, and it's also 8:32 here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill. Well, to preview this week's edition of our weekly food show, The Menu, we meet an important figure of Portugal's cuisine scene.
As you may know, Portuguese food has been undergoing something of a renaissance lately. More and more gastro-tourists come to the streets of Lisbon or Porto hunting for authenticity, and young trainees return with skills from abroad. This is creating a soulful mix of tradition and new ideas, as José Avilés, Portugal's best-known chef, tells Monocle correspondent Simon Tariq backstage in his Lisbon restaurant.
It is safe to say that Belcanto is Lisbon's best restaurant, at least according to the critics and connoisseurs who keep coming back. 20 chefs work the kitchen for just a 50-person capacity, and its young head chef, José Avilés, has become known for taking Portuguese tradition and twisting it into playful creations that reference the country's food staples. Take Waves Breaking, a Belcanto dish served in a shell with a variety of seafood, coastal prawn and seaweed sand. Or the Suckling Pig Revisited, served with an orange sauce in geometric forms. Though Avilés has opened the capital's first gastronomically molecular restaurant, culinary soul is more important to the chef than haute cuisine technique.
I don't know exactly what is molecular gastronomy. I think it's more the science, when we applicate science to the kitchen, but I think those molecules, it's kind of a seasoning in terms of what you are serving. It cannot be the meal, it cannot be the whole meal, but you can give some details with that kind of food and we'll give you an extra. But we definitely think or act local. We want to use Portuguese products. We want to use Portuguese flavors. I can revisit a Portuguese dish and making this Suckling Pig that we have here is a revisit to Suckling Pig, but I can make some seafood with some pine nuts. That's very Portuguese because we have a lot of pine nut trees. So it's not revisiting the food, but revisiting the landscapes, revisit the spirit of Portugal. And I think it's how we see the Portuguese, a new Portuguese fine dining. Definitely trying to have our own identity. And it's not a static place. It's a place that you continue to go. It's like even the traditional food, it's always in change. So I think in Balkan we do that. We're trying to do better every day. We try to promote the small producers to use Portuguese ingredients, Portuguese flavors, and to tell a story. It's a story about Portugal, a story about Lisbon, a story about us. It's all about that.
Inés Menezes, a radio presenter and food writer for the weekend magazine Sábado, believes that chefs like Avilés, despite their fame, are symbolic of the back-to-basics trend that has been triggered not only by the crisis in the country, but a shaking off of the muteness of post-dictatorship times.
The great chefs tell all the time that we have the most fantastic fish in the world, you know? So I think we are finally having a good relationship with our food, and this is new. We are having a more connection with other people, maybe. During many years we are in silence, so it was terrible for our complex. Yeah, it's like a complex. I think the hardest thing is to discover the simple things. It's like in advertising. You have to work a lot to find a simple expression. We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being. But I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity. And now there's a new generation like José Avilés, Lyubomir Stanisic. They are doing another kind of food, and it's very important. I think in the next 5 years, the food will be more simple. I don't know. I think curiosity is always a tool. So in my case, I would like to know more about food, but I'm working for that simplicity that I told you. The fish, the good potatoes, the good salad, it's perfect. I don't need the Nouvelle Cuisine.
Do you know the word comer, to eat? Comer, the origin of the word actually means to eat with. And only in Portugal and Spain we have that. So the concept of eating with others, it's to share. And when we are cooking, we are thinking about that also. It's very important that, especially in fine dining, when we think about that, it's the whole experience what we are cooking. So it means that even if you are eating alone, who is serving is sharing with the people. And that's very important. It's important for you to think about that when you are cooking.
José Avilés will soon open his fourth restaurant in the Portuguese capital. Café Lisboa will evoke the old-style meeting places where everyone from writers to workmen would meet for conversation and simple food. As more outsiders discover Lisbon's culinary gems, it looks like its citizens are also rekindling their love for the best of Portugal. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
And you can catch more food reports from around the globe on this week's edition of The Menu, premiering tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to a rather hungrier now, Midori House. We'll be back right after this with our man in Budapest.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Thank you. And welcome back. You're listening to Majori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 9:39 in Budapest. It's 8:39 here in London.
But it's Budapest where we head now. Time to check what makes the headlines in Eastern Europe. And our man in Budapest is on the line. Adam Labor, lovely to have you on the show.
Good morning.
Shall we start with the closure of the IMF office in Budapest? Not likely to be much missed, is it?
No, it's not. And it's interesting that it's happening now. The current incumbent, the IMF sends a kind of delegate slash ambassador to countries that want one. And the term of the current incumbent runs out next month. And normally they're renewed, but the government has said, we don't need you in here anymore. And they've sent them packing. So the IMF has said sort of rather sniffily, well, if you don't want us, then we don't want to be there. So never mind. But they're packing up and going. But there's a political reason for this as well, that the IMF is deeply unpopular in Hungary, as it is in many countries. And Hungary says it's going to repay its loan even before it's due, probably by the end of the year. So we don't need the IMF kind of here snooping around and telling us what to do.
And this, of course, happened. Hungary was Central Europe's most indebted nation. It needed a $20 billion euro rescue package from the IMF. How will this play domestically? Is this going to be seen very positively then? Then the Prime Minister is saying he wants to pay back this loan early and he wants to close that office from the IMF?
Oh, definitely. I think something like 50 or 60% of Hungarians think the IMF is too influential and has too much power, and it's generally very unpopular. No, and I think it's it'd be true of lots of countries. I mean, institutions like the IMF are not generally popular, especially in places with troubled economies. They come in and they tell people what to do and cut wages and salaries and sack people. Like if you look at what's happening in Greece. So yeah, there'll be a big problem for the government in sending the IMF home, definitely.
Adam, let's talk about social cohesion in Hungary. It's not great, is it? And hasn't ever been since the transition from the post-communist era. But it's particularly bad. Tell us why.
Yes, this is a very interesting new report that's just come out that says that Hungary has a very poor, a very low rate of social cohesion. And I think there's many reasons for that. I mean, and you notice it as someone coming from Western Europe to live in Hungary, that there's a very weak charity sector here. People, for example, lots of people don't even trust charities. They think if they give them money, the money is going to get filched or sidetracked along the way. The NGO, the non-governmental organization sector here, is weak also, although it is getting stronger. But, the things that you see in other countries in Western Europe, this sort of strong civic sense, just doesn't happen here. It's not happening here, or it's happening much more slowly. And one of the big reasons for that, of course, is because it's the legacy of communism. Under communism, the system and the government and the state, they weren't providing services for you. They weren't imposed on you, backed by Russian tanks. So it was a patriotic duty, really, to, whether you could have them and avoid your civic duties, almost a kind of passive resistance. But people haven't quite made the shift to realize that in a democracy, you make your own system. So if you've still got that attitude, then society becomes much more atomized.
And Adam, this study did compare 34 different countries to measure that social cohesion that you're talking about. You mentioned communism there, obviously Hungary being formerly a communist country. How does it rank when you compare it to other Eastern or Central European countries?
Well, that's interesting. If you compare it to countries to the south and the east, like Romania, Serbia, Bosnia, Bulgaria, is much better because there still is this kind of folk memory in Hungary, that before the Second World War it was a sort of quasi-democracy. Before that it was the dual monarchy. It was the Austro-Hungarian monarchy after 1867. So there is still a sense in Hungary that, they're part of the West and that it is a democracy. So it's much better than its neighbours to the south and to the east. I mean, for example, there's a foundation here that helps homeless people. And you can, if you see a homeless person in the winter, you can ring them up and say there's someone sleeping rough here. And within about 10 minutes, they'll have a van out with blankets and off, take them to a hospital and that kind of, help, which is done, it's not a government thing, that's done by volunteers. and by donation. So it is getting better in that sense, but it still has a way to go, I'd say, to catch up with, say, Germany or Austria.
Well, it has a long way to go to catch up to Germany and Austria. So what is the government actually doing? Have you noticed a new slew of perhaps social programs or programs to encourage better social cohesion in Hungary?
Well, I would say not that much, really. I mean, the government has a very specific view of Hungarian society, and it's sort of quite nostalgic for the days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in many ways. It's quite nationalistic. Its rhetoric is based around the idea of the Hungarian nation. But I don't know, a lot of people don't really buy into that. You know, the younger, more modern generation are not so interested in that. So the government, in that sense, can be quite divisive rather than inclusive.
Adam, I know from being a Londoner that nothing divides the social fabric like cyclists getting in the way of cars and vice versa. Is this going to help now in Hungary because Budapest's getting a whole new load of cycling lanes? Is that right?
Yes, it is. And the cycling situation is definitely getting better. And people who've visited here, you know, environmental experts and transport experts say that actually Budapest is becoming rather good with this, slightly to my surprise, because, you know, I remember a few years ago, if you cycled in Budapest traffic on a bike, you were really taking your life in your hands. But there's a lot more cycle lanes now. You know, for example, you can cycle across Margaret Bridge onto Margaret Island in a very nice cycle lane, completely protected from the traffic, actually, on the bridge, which got widened. Downtown, they're opening up some of the bus lanes for cyclists.
So, to clarify, the cyclists will be sharing with the bus. They're not dedicated cycle lanes, these 10 new lanes.
Well, I think they might be carving out a bit of the bus lane, you know, for the cyclists. But the point is that cars don't go in the bus lanes here because there's cameras everywhere. And if you get caught in a bus lane, then you're going to get a fine. So it's fairly safe to be, you know, it's much safer to be in a bus lane than to be in a main road. But there's also some proper dedicated cycle lanes as well, because on many of the older boulevards and avenues here, they have very wide pavements. And you know, you don't need actually that much space to make a two-lane cycle lane. So you're seeing more and more of that around. And just generally more cyclists. And so the more there are around, the more people become aware of them.
Well, I think when we had the Barclays bikes here in London, what, 2 years ago, wasn't it? And there's been this huge explosion of cycling across London. And, I you know, here in London, they're installing at least some kind of cycle superhighways across the city.
I was in New York last week, and City have installed their own version of the Paris-Vélib' and the London Boris
they're
bikes.
Calling the Bloomberg bike or something
they're
like that.
Well, they're city bikes, I think. It seems to be the thing all across the rage in all cities. So. Well,
it's good to encourage cycling no matter what. Mm. Adam Labor in Budapest, many thanks.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada City Cheche.
From London,
London. London, caralho.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, in a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's Brazilian front pages with our Brazilian resident, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. But to keep up with the beautiful weather and before our newspaper review, we'll listen to a Brazilian ballad that made the summer of 96 a happier place for Fernando. This is La Bella Luna by Palalamas do Sossego. And that was Paralamos do Suseca with La Bella Luna. And Fernando Augusto Pacheco, you're joining us in the studio. That was your song of 1996. You said it made you a happier place.
Oh, much happier place. On a sunny, beautiful sunny afternoon, drinking some passion fruit juice with a lot of ice.
You were only 10 in 1996, yeah. We should
let's put things in context,
but
right?
I really love the fact that you have a song for every single summer of your life. I think that's a wonderful idea. I'm going to steal it.
I'm still deciding which song is going to be for 2013, but I'll let you know, guys.
What are the contenders?
Well, there's Azealia Banks, Pet Shop Boys, but, you know, let's wait.
It's a tough competition, Fernando.
Very tough.
It must be a tough job.
Absolutely.
Well, you've got some of the Brazilian front pages for us this morning. Where shall we begin?
Well, let's begin with O Globo. And it's quite a funny story. Well, first of all, let's say the Pope is visiting Brazil next week for the Catholic Youth Festival, and it's a huge deal in the country because, one thing or not, Brazil is still the largest Catholic country in the world, even though the numbers of Catholics have been dropping sharply, actually, in the last years. But this new Pope is kind of more simple. Even the clothes he wears, he's not as extravagant as Pope Benedictus, you know. So and he said, for example, people said, oh, you should use armored glass in your Papa Mobile when you're in Rio, and he said, absolutely not. I don't want to wear. I want to be with the people, you know. So he's quite a charismatic Pope.
This is the guy who takes the bus to work. And
exactly.
Very, down with the people.
And he's Latin American. Let's not forget that as well.
So what can we expect from the Catholic Youth Festival?
Well, there will be more than 1 million people in Rio. And of course, there will be a lot of police officers because, you know, they're worried about, you know, the protests had just been like a month ago. So the governor of Rio said, oh my God, yeah, we should really watch out on that. And there's already some other funny things happening as well. In the beaches in Rio, it's very common to have some sculptors. They do these sand sculptures of beautiful women wearing tiny bikinis, you know? You know, that's common practice in Rio. But
wait,
now,
there are beautiful women in Brazil?
They wear bikinis?
In bikinis?
A couple. I know, it sounds very strange, but, you know, we do have some. Sorry.
About three.
Yeah. And some men as well, wearing speedos. Never mind. But it's funny because of the Pope is visiting, and actually he's going to be in Copacabana giving a speech, they have to cover up. So they're putting... There's actually a picture here. So the women, instead, they're going to wear some skirts and some kangas, you know, to cover up their
bottoms. I can't even work out what that sculpture is. Is that just a woman's bare bottom
with a skirt on that, a sand skirt. Exactly.
Also, but do you think
like
this
out of respect for the Pope.
Do you think this will change sartorial habits on the beach itself in Copacabana when he's there?
No, this is just for the week, you know, let's say.
No, I don't mean forever, but I mean while he's in town, will people dress a little bit more conservatively, do you think?
Well, some people do, you know, especially if you're kind of a Catholic, but you know, actually, there'll be another protest. Some gay activists, they'll be close to where he's going to give the speech. And they're organizing like a massive public kiss. So there'll be a lot of gay couples and saying, yeah, to be gay is fine, Mr. Pope, you know.
That's a nice idea.
Do we know if the Pope will be around to see that massive kiss?
I think
probably
he will.
Not.
I think he will, because he's going to give a speech in an open space.
Is he going to acknowledge it, do you think, in his speech?
I don't think so. I think the Catholic Church is advancing, but not that much.
Not that much.
And you've got
hope.
Another story from the O Globo. Someone's back. Who's back?
Lula is back, you know, our previous president, and he's still massively charismatic. But since the protest started, he kind of disappeared from the Brazilian media. And finally, he said yesterday, first of all, he refused that he's going to be the candidate in 2014. And he said he supports Dilma 100% and said she's going to win the re-election. And it's interesting because there was a poll released recently in Brazil saying that actually he would get 40% of the vote if there will be elections now, and Dilma would only get 30%.
Wow.
And before the protest, she had 56%. So it was a huge, huge drop.
She was really his favorite. She was sort of his anointed successor. Do you think what will he do to kind of mitigate against that? Because that's not great news for Dilma. Higher than her.
And you know what's interesting about Lula? Because, you know, he's still massively charismatic. He hasn't done much to support Dilma. Of course, he says, like he said in the speech yesterday. But I think he should kind of really get involved more in Brazilian politics. Maybe this will help Dilma. Because if Lula is not there, I think Dilma... Well, she was kind of elected because of his support, in a way.
And because of these protests that have been happening over the last month or so, another perhaps more unlikely candidate has really seen a surge in the polls, the Green Party's candidate, Marina Silva.
Absolutely. Actually, she was the previous Green Party leader. Now she's creating a new party called Partido da Sustentabilidade. And, you know, she's actually got 22% of the vote, so just 8 points behind Dilma. And in some sectors of society, like among the rich, the students, she's actually winning. And that's usually a sign that actually she has lots to increase, you know, so especially among the poor who might not even know who is she yet.
Because the elections it's still a far way off, isn't it?
It's far away, but I think Brazil is becoming like the U.S. We're talking like a year before we already kind of know who will be who the candidates will be and everything.
Let's talk briefly about the protests and how they rumble on. There's a quite shocking picture across the papers this morning of shop windows being smashed and all sorts of carnage. Tell us more. You've picked out a column in the Sao Paulo.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a story in Folha de São Paulo about Rio. We're not trying to say anything bad about Rio, but you know, it's funny because there was some protests in Leblon yesterday. Leblon is kind of the richest neighborhood in Rio. It's kind of the Mayfair of Rio.
Right.
And some protesters attacked last night 25 shops. You know, I mean, as you can see, there's a picture here with a kind of a broken glass in the window, a photographer taking picture, all very dramatic. But my favorite columnist, his name is Chico Sá. He did a very funny kind of column because, you know, Manuel Carlos is like a soap opera author, and every soap opera he portrays the life of the rich in Leblon. And usually the leading characters are called Helena. And then he said, the title of his column is Helena's in Panic. They can't even walk around to go to their favorite meals in their luxury islands in Leblon. So very, if you do speak Portuguese, I would definitely recommend you to read
his
column.
Is it specific, though, to, I mean, why are the protests there specifically at the moment? Is it targeted precisely because it's the richest neighborhood?
As I said, Brazilians are enjoying their moments of protest. So, and of course, Leblon is where the rich live. So why not do a protest there, I think.
Excellent stuff, Fernando. Thanks very much for coming in. Have a great weekend. And you'll have to let us know what the summer song of 2013 is. It's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who put together a very lovely show, and Tess McCann as well. And our studio manager this morning was Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is Section D with Alid John. And I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds from Midori House at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Clemency Burton Hill. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.